look at Nepal and India. I speak the same language as Nepalese do, but look at Nepal. They have half as much GDP per capita, and institutionally, it's far more fragile because British never built institutions there. So that is the situation of Nepal. The situation, and these people, of course, young people are extraordinarily ecstatic that they have brought in a change. But I absolutely guarantee you that a year from now, when we talk again, Nepal will be far worse than it is today.
Jayant Bhandari, good morning to you, my friend. It's good to see you.
Hi, good morning to you too, Andy, and thanks for having me back.
Yeah, well, thank you for coming on. And I was just going through my interviews and my guests and people that I like to talk to. And I was like, I haven't talked to you in it's been too long. And it's been, I don't know, 2, 3 months. And the world is just falling apart, getting exciting. However way you want to say that, and especially where you're an expert at in all over Asia, really. Let's start with Nepal. Tell me what's going on there and what's happened.
Nepal, Andy, has a population higher than that of Australia, but it is an unknown country, and for the right reason. The GDP per capita of Nepal is half as that of India. It's $1,400 per capita, and so bad is the situation in Nepal that India starts looking better in comparison. Now, India is an absolute hellhole, so you can then imagine what Nepal would be like. Historically, people of Nepal in India, men in India of Nepalese origin in India were seen as security guards, and women of Nepalese origin in India were seen as prostitutes. So that's how bad the situation of Nepal is. And my view is that Lord of the Flies, people who have read the book will recognize what I'm talking about, is being enacted in Nepal right now. It is the teens of Nepal who have taken over Nepal right now. Clearly, this has happened because the mid-aged people and the elders have given up everything. They have lost all hope from Nepal. So they are in the back seat. They don't want to do anything. But it also tells you so much about child rearing that these people have not really tried to discipline or educate their teens. And these teens have gone completely wild. These teens have taken over Nepal's governance, and they have appointed an ex-judge justice as the interim prime minister. They beat up other ministers. They beat up the prime minister. The prime minister is absconding. So, and there's absolutely no doubt that these people were extraordinarily corrupt. The prime minister, the just ex-prime minister is a Communist Party leader. The same Nepalese were romantic about the Communist Party until not too long, and now they are fighting against corruption. Now, any teen who hasn't really interacted with life, in my view, has no claim on being not corrupt because he is very likely to give in to temptations. Character is built through a process of interacting with life, not through sitting back and having glorious dreams in your mind. So basically, the next regime will be more corrupt, more tyrannical, and it will be Lord of the Flies being enacted in Nepal. Institutions were always weak in Nepal. Remember, Nepal was never colonized, which means that they never got the benefit of European colonization and institution. So the institutions of checks and balances don't exist in Nepal. Nepal is also a great example of for those people who claim that colonization was bad for the third world. Look at Nepal and India. I speak the same language as Nepalese do, but look at Nepal. They have half as much GDP per capita, Institutionally, it's far more fragile because British never built institutions there. So that is the situation of Nepal. And these people, of course, young people are extraordinarily ecstatic that they have brought in a change. But I absolutely guarantee you that a year from now, when we talk again, Nepal will be far worse than it is today. And it is on its path to self-destruction.
As you say that, so there's very little hope is what you're, is what I'm gathering.
I didn't say there's very little hope. I said there's no hope. There's no hope from any of these third world hellholes. But Nepal has taken a fast track approach to destroying itself. Because now, as it stands, institutions don't exist. They have burned down the parliament building. They have burned down the Supreme Court, which basically means that whatever was left, and that was actually fully legitimate in my view, Andy. Nepal is an extraordinarily corrupt place, as is India. However, I always think in terms of what will come next. If I get rid of the corrupt regime now, am I going to get a better regime, or am I going to get Lord of the Flies? And unfortunately, I clearly see Lord of the Flies taking over.
Okay, so what does this mean for the region? Meaning, is India looking at this to go in? Is China potentially looking to go in to either take assets or to, in a perfect world, which is not going to happen, but to bring some kind of stability? And I'm specifically thinking actually of China here.
Andy, in my view, this is one of those unique situations where a foreign interference to stabilize situation in Nepal might be required. But I seriously doubt if anyone is going to touch it, because whosoever touches it will get all the bad name that comes from the outcome of it. And Nepalese will hate that country for interfering in their country. So this is just a horrible situation for Nepal. India has historically had a bad name for interfering in the affairs of Nepal, and they probably always interfere anyway. And they have blackmailed Nepal in the past. So India has a bad name, despite that Nepal and India are the only two countries. Nepal is the only country with which India has an open border, which means that you don't need a visa regime. You can come into India and work, and vice versa. So India should be trying to stabilize it. But unfortunately, Indian politicians are completely brain dead, tyrannical, and valueless, that they have no moral high ground to try to interfere in Nepal. And India continues to occupy landmass of Nepal, which legitimately should be negotiated and probably returned back to Nepal. So the situation is very bad. My guess is that China is not going to interfere much, because it does not want a bad name. It already has an unnecessary bad name, in my view. But also, China prefers a buffer state like Nepal rather than have India, more of India, at its border. So my guess is that China will probably stay away from interfering, because China is a very inward-looking country. It wants to see and it wants to do what is beneficial for its own citizens. They don't really care about what happens elsewhere. Now, of course, that shows that China does not have the grand heart that Western people have. But that also means that they don't get into foreign misadventure, which actually might worsen the situation in other countries.
Got it. So that being said, work out a little bit with me the whole BRICS situation with India and China. It sounds like they're becoming friendly trading partners. Is that the truth?
No, India can never be a friend of any country, because India is a country without any values, without any moral fabric, and without any rationality. And top that up with the fact that Indian politicians and bureaucrats are horrendously corrupt and brain dead and sadistic. So when you add all these things, you realize that India is run on the basis of might is right. It goes and prostrate in front of powerful countries and powerful people, and tyrannizes the smaller countries like Bangladesh and Maldives and Nepal. So India can never have friends. And in fact, that is the really the situation with any personal interaction with Indians. When I interact with Indians, within seconds and within minutes, they want to size you up and they want to place yourself either higher than themselves or lower than them. If they place me higher in their minds than me higher than themselves in their minds, they start calling me sir three times in a sentence. And if they consider me lower, they start abusing me right away. So that is unfortunately the situation with India. India cannot have friends. Indians don't have friends. They only have transactional relationships of conveniences with other countries and other people. So India has a habit of backstabbing. It cannot really come together with other countries to work for mutual benefit. India does not believe in a positive-sum game. It does not even believe in a zero-sum game. It believes in a negative-sum game, which means that you have to lose before they can feel good in an association with you. So unfortunately, India will not be a friend. And I realized that I was listening to a video, watching a video between Sergio Gore, who will be the next ambassador of the US to India. And he was talking about how important it is to be friends with India. And I was thinking how naive he is. At least what he's saying was full of naivety, because India cannot be a friend. Now, India is the most populous country on the planet. So when you add up these hungry, starving, wretched people, adding up to a 1.5 billion, for a foreigner's perspective, India matters, because although he might be using a few drops of oil every day, when you multiply that with 1.5 billion from the perspective of America and UAE and Russia, India matters. But India does not matter on a per capita basis. Right now, from what I see, Modi has very badly hurt Trump in some ways, and I don't fully understand that. In September last year, when Modi came to the US, Trump wanted Modi's help to advertise himself to Indian Americans. Now, I don't like using this hyphenated term, but it matters here. Because Indian Americans, despite that they left the hellhole of India, are very romantic about India. And they are very pro-Modi, who is a fanatic and who has destroyed whatever was left of the Indian institutions. But from Trump's point of view, he wanted votes of these 5 million people, because at the margin, this is what matters in who wins the elections. Modi refused to go to meet Trump because he realized that Trump wasn't going to win. So clearly he hurt Trump there. Also in 2019, Trump wanted to be a mediator to discuss about Kashmir, and Modi did not want it. And this is crazy, because India does not want to discuss with either China or Pakistan or have mediator. Now, you can't really sort out problems if you can't really mediate. But then at the end of the day, India, because it works, it's a valueless country and it cannot really have a real partnership with people. The problem with India is that India cannot be the staging ground for the US in that region. US wants India to provide its facilities to counter China. India does not have the courage. It wants to belong to nowhere. It belongs. It wants to belong everywhere. It wants to please everyone. And because both of these countries are superpowers, China and the US, it does not want to displease anyone. Now, that's not how it works, particularly if you're stupid. With Singapore, it works very well, because Singapore keeps good relations with China and the US both, but they are very smart, very thorough, very educated people. Now, Indian politicians and bureaucrats are stupid, as I said, and sadistic and tyrannical and really brain dead. And that is really the biggest problem with Indian governance today. So now India doesn't want to be on the side of the US. And ironically, India is a part of two groups which are a conflicting organization. One is Quads. Quad is an organization to defend certain countries from China. This Quad is made up of Japan, Australia, US, India. And at the same time, India is a participant in what is called Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is an organization to keep stability and security with China and the Central Asian republics. Now, how can you belong to both the organizations? Because India, and how can India even belong to Shanghai Cooperation Organization when India claims that it is China and Pakistan which create instability in the region? So it just has no vision, and that lack of vision comes from an amoral society and irrational way of thinking.
So talk to me about, correct me if I'm wrong, they're buying a lot of Russian oil. Is that relationship going to implode, Russia and India? No?
No, it isn't going to implode. And I can understand that that is another factor behind the anger of Trump. Trump understands that he cannot stop oil flow to China, but he can threaten, because India responds to threats by getting India to stop Russian oil. And if Russian oil stops going to India, a lot of revenue that flows into Russian coffers on a daily basis could stop. That should add up to about $150 million on a daily basis. So it's a lot of money. But unfortunately, India is a country run on expediency. And as I said, might is right, which means that India wants cheaper oil. But also, I think India has certain reasons to keep its association with Russia going, because US has in the past partnered up with Pakistan and against India. So if you look at that history, India has a reason to not mess up its relationship with Russia. Now, Indians actually don't have a relationship with Russia. They claim that they are friends. It's only a relationship of convenience. But India will continue to buy oil. I think Trump fully understood that India will continue to buy oil. I think Trump's biggest frustration with India is that India belongs to nowhere. It honors no contracts, and it has no value system, which means that it just comes across as a slimy government which feels repulsed rather than have a good time with them and interact with them on how to make things better.
So it's just purely transactional then with Russia here. You don't expect
relationship. No, there is no no, everything is absolutely transactional with Russia. In fact, in the relationship of Indians and India with any counterparty is almost always transactional. So unfortunately, that's the mindset. And this, you again have to remember that when you have an amoral society, you cannot have friendship. Friendship is a civilizational concept. Love is a civilizational concept, which emerges when you have a moral fabric. India does not have a moral fabric, which means that it does not have the values that are required to make it a civilization. And friendship and love are very important ingredients of that. And as a result, you cannot really have a friendship with India. And ironically, Andy, if you look through this thing properly, you would find it hilarious that despite that China is, from US's point of view, our biggest criminal, US imposes only 30% tariffs on China, but imposes 50% tariff on India. Because eventually you just get repulsed by how Indian government behaves. And I tell you, when I have to go to a government office in India, I'm just so, it just, you know, it's like dealing with the slimy cesspool. Where the only thing is this really brain-dead, chimpanzee-like bureaucrat sitting in front of you and asking idiotic question, which you cannot really respond to. And they don't really have the brains to understand. If they were corrupt and intelligent, I would have accepted that, but they are stupid at the same time. So unfortunately, I think Trump has found himself extraordinarily frustrated with India.
Got it. So let's pivot a little bit to China. I know that you're an investor in China. You love, well, I don't want to put words in your mouth. You do business in China. You've been to China many times and often. How are they being affected in this new world that's really since Trump's taken office with the tariffs as well as their economy? Talk about that.
So I indeed like China, and I think it's could easily become the next America. China is doing a lot of things right. I have continued to see a massive improvement in China over the last 16 years of my trips to China. I have spent months at a time in China. I have been to small villages. I have interacted with bureaucrats. I have done a lot of things in China, and I really have come to admire that country. Now, is it perfect? Is it a perfect place? Not in any way or form, whatever, but it has done extraordinarily well, so well that I don't think any country in the past achieved in that kind of time duration. Now, when I talk with young people in China, they are paranoid. They are worried about their future. There is joblessness in China, property prices have crashed. And there is this fear among young people. Andy, the reality is that despite what they say, I actually perceive this as a positive thing because intelligent people who think about the future are always paranoid. It is the paranoid who survive, not the easygoing people who survive. So that actually leaves me with a positive impression about China. Also, Chinese can be very self-reflective. They understand that the US has a bigger economic power. So they are rightly fearful rather than being arrogant about the situation. Chinese have mostly held low and continue to improve. I think that any economic problems between India and between China and the US will eventually mean that China will generate inner resources to manufacture, say, chips themselves or higher technology themselves. So don't underestimate China. China would not have got where it has without the US, but at this moment, don't think that it cannot make cover up its deficiencies by resolute endeavors. So and China is a real competitor of the US, and I wish really that they worked together rather than fight.
Yeah. So talk to me a little bit about Japan. I know that you also have been to Japan many times and South Korea. Do you still like the outlook for those countries with everything that's going on?
Well, with Japan, I'm becoming a bit unsure, Andy, although this is just slightly unsure. And the reason is that Japan has started allowing foreigners to come and work in the country, which is something similar, which is resulting into massive civil conflicts in the Western society. Now, thankfully, Japan does not give out its passports to foreigners. You could be living there for decades and they will still not give you their passports. So at least there's this silver lining to what they are doing. I was talking with a company recently and the company told me, hey, don't quote me, but for the first time, we have started taking theft insurance. So,
Wow.
yeah, so
Wow.
because in Japan, you can just leave your stuff outside. You can leave your bicycle unlocked. You don't really worry about anything. But now copper wires are getting stolen. And Japanese being so extraordinarily polite, they won't talk about it. But now those things are happening, which did not happen in Japan earlier. Now, Japanese can, of course, they have a cultural background that if needed, they can become racist. And unfortunately, they will if this inflow of foreigners continue. they will become racist fast, faster than Western people ever can or could. So I hope Japan understands that having too many foreigners is going to create social conflicts. And at least I hope they continue not to give out their passports to foreigners.
Got it. Work your way down, I guess, to Southeast Asia, Thailand, and Singapore. Do you still like those countries as investment choices? Yeah.
Well, I have never taken an interest in investing in Thailand. Thailand is it's a nice country. I always get a nice feeling going to Thailand. But it is not a country that is going to have a future. It's a country that will always be stuck in this second world middle class country status forever. I don't see an innovative thinking in that society to the degree Thailand and Indonesia do well, or even Philippines do well. It is because of the Chinese ethnic population that they have. So if you remove that, this is a sort of easygoing country where people don't really care much about either spiritual values or higher technology. So I don't think Thailand has much of a future that way. But thankfully, because it's a homogeneous country, it is reasonably calm socially. Politically, it has been very chaotic for decades now, but thankfully that it stays only in politics. Military comes and goes. The society somehow manages to keep going the normal way without much violence coming on the streets of violence between different groups happening on the streets. Singapore is a different place altogether. It's one of the richest, it is the top two richest countries on the planet. And this was a malaria infested third world country 40 years back. But thankfully it has 80% Chinese population, and they have done an extraordinarily good job of elevating themselves from nothing to becoming the top country in the world in wealth. At the same time, Andy, as you know, earlier last decade, I lived in Singapore for a couple of years. I continue to admire it. I still think that somehow China is doing better than Singapore in terms of higher order factors. And China is, I think, doing better than Japan as well. The thing is that if you look at the past of Singapore, the direction of the country was set by the government. Now, there's nothing against it. That's how it had to be done to rapidly progress and improve the country. Despite the fact that I'm a libertarian and I should be anti-statist, but it is what it is. China, in my view, have become more creative and innovative compared to, or at least the bigger cities. If I go to Shenzhen or Shanghai, I see more innovative approaches to life than you might see in Singapore. So I think Singapore probably has some work to do to open up to more creativity, somehow develop more creativity. Unfortunately, when I said nice things about China in terms of creativity, it's only in comparison to other Asian countries. China itself has its own problem where there's a lot of peer pressure, suppression of creativity, and somehow China has to, and that's why I said China absorbed nutrition from the US and has become a competitor.
Excuse me.
So, they really have to work hard on figuring out how to underpin their enormous economic growth and economic potential with philosophical underpinnings, which requires this creativity and unleashing of their the shackles of their minds, which unfortunately continues to be the case in all these Korean, Japanese, and Chinese societies.
Work out for me with all of this being said, then. What is your opinion on the BRICS? Is that going to even work with India being such a major component of that? As well as, I mean, it's hard for me with what you just said, them working at all with China and Russia to especially to have a stable currency as well as stable trade.
Well, you have answered your own question, and the answer is no. There are only two countries in BRICS, which are China and Russia, and they work together well anyway. There is no other country, and it's not just about India. It's every other country in BRICS is a useless country. South Africa is a useless country, very dysfunctional politics, similar kind of lack of values. Now, I understand South Africa was a first world country at one point of time. But I'm talking about the current regime. Brazil is similar. Now they are much better than India in many ways. Their GDP per capita is 3 or 4 or 5 times that of India. So that's clearly a reflection of being better than India, but they are still not up to the mark in terms of participating in an international organization. So BRICS has no future by itself, but it does not really matter, Andy. China is getting done what it wants get done. Chinese are inward-looking people. They don't want to be front-seaters. They want to keep their head low and get on with life. And this is what I think Chinese government is doing. It's hiding behind BRICS, get done what it wants done, and then it will probably doesn't care what happens to BRICS thereafter. I think the BRICS by itself will fragment. Fragment in the sense that it will just become dysfunctional. Like there are so many organizations. There's an organization called Commonwealth Countries Organization. I doubt if you have ever heard of it. They are,
Never.
they have their headquarters, and they somehow, it's an organization of 50 or 170 countries who were in the British Commonwealth. No one cares. Nothing comes out of those organizations. They become just lazy organizations which pay $500,000 or $1 million salaries to some sloppy guy at the top. But at the end of the day, I think that's the future of BRICS. Once China has extracted value from it, it will move on.
Talk to me a little bit about, I know that you're an investor, correct me if I'm wrong, in gold. Gold's been doing quite well, and it, correct me if I'm wrong, Chinese, especially the Chinese central government, and now the Chinese people have been big buyers of gold. Do you expect that to continue, China to be big buyers, and do you expect gold to continue its rise?
Looking at my action will tell you more about what I think. I bought gold when I thought the time was right, and I was speaking in favor of buying gold for years. I am holding on to what I have. I have no courage to buy, and I have no reason to buy because I plan ahead that I don't have to desperately get into this fear of missing out. Does it mean I'm selling? No, I'm not, but I'm certainly not buying more. The fearful situation always for me, Andy, is that when prices go up so high, it enables a lot of mines to start coming into production. A lot of scamming and crookedness starts happening. So I have to slow down and start paying less attention and calm myself down. So a lot
Well
of
said.
people are,
Well said.
a lot of people are right now approaching me, asking me about my opinion on gold, and I don't have any opinion for you. I don't want that consulting fees because when I asked you, it was a boring subject for you. Now you are coming to me when I'm just not sure about it anymore.
Yeah. But do you expect the Chinese to continue, or do you have an opinion of the Chinese to continue buying gold?
Oh, I think so. I think it's extremely important for any society to preserve their wealth, and for and our currencies are headed for a complete collapse at some point of time. So even if in real terms gold does not go up in value, in nominal terms it will go up quite a lot in value because of the inflation that is continues to hit our societies across the board. So yes, they will continue to buy gold, and gold will be a lifeboat for many people and many societies. Andy, my situation is that I'm an investment professional. I look for investment opportunities all the time. So if I can find a yielding asset, a real yielding asset, I am very prone to investing and putting my money there. But for most people, and I would say 99% of the people or 99.9% of the people, they are not competent enough to find investment opportunities. The investment opportunities they tend to pick up are usually scams. They are incompetent, and then they end up buying too many properties at at a very high price. For them, if I were in their shoes, I would still be keen on buying gold. And that is why I think gold will continue to go up and continue to consolidate. But at the same time, from my perspective, I can probably find better places to put my new money. I still hold on to what I have had.
Got it. So in this crazy world, this chaotic world that we currently live in, and what we're experiencing is monetary inflation, and a lot of asset prices that shouldn't go have gone up significantly. Where do you look for value? Not really specific to companies, but specific to sectors and specific to countries.
Oh, the value is all over the world. This is absolutely mind-boggling. You can find value in every country, in every sector, there's just so much value. There's just not enough money to invest in those value investments. A lot of smaller companies go completely unseen by the market. Everyone is interested in investing in Alphabet and Apple. Look at those $50 or $100 million companies that continue to give out 10% dividend per year and have a P by E of maybe five, which means that they give out 10% dividend and have a capital appreciation of about 10%. So there are so many companies like those in the midterm and a small sector of the economy. You can, if you don't like something, play the other side of the market using options. And you don't have to sell call options. You can still do a lot of selling. You don't have to buy options. You can sell options to ensure that you are fully covered. There's so much you can do. I think what I really like to do is to be on the other side of the gambling market, other side of the casino. They are very speculative investments, speculative in the negative sense, is investments happening in the market. And while those people are too keen on, too desperate to make 10 times or 100 or 1,000 times of their investments, I'm just happy to make 20, 30% of return on my investment per year. So I can be on the other side of the field, playing the casino management using options. I think China is doing very well. I do a lot of small company investments in China, and they have done extraordinarily well. Because of two reasons. Firstly, smaller companies go unseen by the market, but also because there is this negativity in the West to do with China, which is completely erroneous. Now, I don't know if China is creating problems with fentanyl in the US, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know about those backroom dealings, but China is a far, far, far better country than a lot of people, including my friend, think it is. I recently, last month, I gave a speech on China at my own capitalism and morality seminar. My own friends went against me, saying that China, what about one child policy? What about gulags in China? Hey, I don't know. Maybe I'm not competent enough to respond to that, but I can certainly address the negative views. So many of your negative views, which are completely erroneous. One of them being that they think that China is a paper tiger, and China it isn't, because just about everything you use is now, or at least half of everything you use, is made in China.
Right.
Well, what would you tell all of our viewers and listeners? And there's a lot right now. We've grown exponentially in the last 18 months since we started talking. What would you tell investors and listeners to look out for over the next quarter to the end of the year? What to be aware, both in the macro sense as well as what to look for places to potentially put their money?
Well, it's very hard to foresee what might happen a quarter or a year from now. Unfortunately, things can sometimes take a long time, and things can sometimes happen rather rapidly, as they did in Nepal and Bangladesh. So things can change very quickly. But my general viewpoint is that the third world is not emerging markets. The third world is the shithole of the world, which comprises of two-thirds of the world's population, and the whole of the third world is headed for disintegration. So if I had money in those countries, I would be keen on pulling out unless I knew specific sectors. So I do invest in companies in Africa and in Latin America, but I want a higher, enough of a high return that if they collapse, I make up for my losses through those higher returns. The third world is headed for a collapse. So that's one thing. The Western countries will continue to face civil conflicts, and these civil conflicts will continue to increase. And the key issue is that they have made themselves increasingly low-trust societies and dysfunctional societies by bringing in too many people from the third world who do not assimilate. And those third world people are now becoming almost majority in some of the countries. And certainly they have become the swing voters in every Western country. So Western countries are headed for a chaos. My money really, I think, increasingly belongs to the relatively stable and probably improving countries of China, Hong Kong, Singapore, Japan, Korea. And remember, Hong Kong has already got elevated back to its higher status as one of the freest economies. So you can imagine that China gets all the bad name, but then when good things happen, international media refuses to talk about it.
Yeah, that seems to be the case with just about everything. They'll talk about the stories that they want to talk about or whatever fits their purpose. Giant, you've been exceptional. It's been great getting to know you. I love our talks. Can you give out your website or how can people get in touch with you if they want to do business with you?
Well, I don't do really business with anyone except my established clients, but my website is jayantbhandari.com. And the reason I'm not increasing my business is, Andy, because I want to finish writing a book I'm working on the third world. And I hope I can complete it next year. My website is jayantbhandari.com, and everything I do goes there.
I will put all of this in the show notes and I'll have you on before the book is finished. But all I ask of you is when the book is finished that I have you on so we can talk about it.
Sounds good. That's a commitment.
All right. I want to thank you so much for your time, Giant. Great to see you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Andy, for the opportunity.